Hello and welcome to the National Institute for Gamer Review. I am DK.
I am Lewis, and I am on a somewhat formulaic but ultimately enjoyable adventure.
Aren't we all? Aren't we all? Yes, and we are joined here today by a friend of the program, Zoomer Imperator, or I think we'll just be calling. I know there's a million Zoomers. It's funny to watch the Zoomers kind of come of age and become a thing unto themselves. It's and I've known more than one Zoomer that's identified themselves as such in their online
handle.
But anyway, how's it going? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on. This has been something that's been in the works for a long time, and I'm glad we finally get to sit down and do it.
Yeah. Yes, and I know you, because I believe we had mentioned Tintin before in connection with Leon DeGrelle, which I had not been aware of at all, that there was any kind of, what amounts to essentially biographical inspiration for the character in the person of Leon DeGrelle. And of course, we'll get into some of that. But yeah, you reached out, you wanted to do something about Tintin, and Tintin's one of those things that it's interesting in a couple different ways. I guess you're probably more of a fan than I was. I was certainly a fan growing up as a young boy. I think there's something about the character and the setting, and just it's also a very interesting time. It captures this, but we'll get into all that too, I guess, with the 1930s as this kind of last flowering of a global facing European culture that was sure of itself prior to the conflagration in the 40s. But how old were you, or the both of you? Because I know you were both like me. I mean, I was what, maybe 12 years old or so when I discovered Tintin. How about y'all?
Yeah, so I was I was about, if you want to go first, Lewis.
No, mine's less interesting.
Okay. So I was about, I think, 6, and this might make y'all feel old, but so Netflix was first rising on online streaming service, and they had the cartoon, the 90s Canadian Ellipse Nelvana cartoon of Tintin on there. And so, you know, my siblings and I, we started watching it, and it was something really appealing, you know, just as someone who's always been interested in history and historical aesthetics. It was pretty cool. And of course, you know, the adventures are always entertaining, and also kind of the groundedness of how, I think, you know, Tintin's an imaginary hero, but in a real world. And I think that definitely opens up a sense of wonder that's appeals to the sensibilities of, you know, all young people, young boys especially, but I think especially European sensibilities as well. So then from there, From the show, I got into the books, and of course, you know, I was still a kid when the Spielberg movie came out. So, yeah, that's how I got.
Which is surprisingly good, by the way. And if you haven't seen it, I didn't actually even know there was. Now that you mention it, I kind of have big flashes of a cartoon. I'm not sure if I may be hallucinating that. I don't know, but the movie I had very low expectations for. I didn't watch it when it came out. I just expected it was trash, and it just captured the spirit of what I remembered from the books quite well.
I think it does. It was always a favorite among my siblings and I. My sister, when she was little, she had a big crush on him. So
of course. And what about you, Lewis?
I was actually not really aware of, I am also a Zoomer, not really aware of Tintin as a, thing, but I was aware of the genre. I had a very Francophile, you know, a lot of French kids books in the house that were translated English or like French. I don't know if like Madeleine is actually a French book or like French, but French presenting.
I think it is. I think Madeleine is French.
Books for kids. And Tintin was there, but didn't super grab me. And it was just kind of one of those things around. I never actually got super. I was probably a little too young when I first exposed to it. And then I didn't get back around to reading it till it was like, till like, this is very Zoomer. till I saw like the meme, like Tintin memes. And then I
the captain on, you know, captain yeah. is Wednesday. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's funny. No, I guess a similar kind of thing, but I definitely had both Tintin and Asterix growing up and quite enjoyed both of those, the comics and Asterix had some cartoons that were pretty good. I didn't watch the those are in French, but yeah, it's a certain kind of window, because when you initially proposed this, Zoomer, I was on board, but I was also, it was a funny moment of reflection of like, yeah, I had read a bunch of these when I was 12 to 15, and then I just hadn't thought about it in, you know, so, yeah, like multiple, more than two decades, right?
Right. And it was something I had originally reached out to Borzoi about back when he was still doing hyper podcastism, because I knew he was a fan, and he was like, you know, yeah, I'm just doing way too much stuff. And I was like, oh, you know, it's sure. Would it be something that DK and Lewis would be interested in? So. But yeah, I'm glad it opened up.
Yeah,
opened it
well, up so I think for us, and certainly for me, the I hadn't read a Tintin comic in a long, long time, and so I was thinking like, yeah, okay, let me. And I asked for your top five, and I perused them, and yeah, it was basically as I remembered. There were some things about it that stuck out. One of which was which Lewis kind of alluded to in the in his stinger that there's a certain kind of formulaic nature to the. Like the overarching plots have, you know, some amount of something to them, and there's a lot of, you know, frame by frame action and jokes and different things going on, but a lot of it falls into a kind of cartoon. I mean, the thing is, I think it's easy to forget. Not that I'll be right back. Kids are fighting.
I can talk about it. Yeah. So. Every Tintin arc goes kind of, let's call it like the same. Well, whatever. This sounds too denigrating, but like it's not. But you know, he's on a boat to a place, right? Or an airplane, but almost always a boat.
Right.
Something happens on the boat. He encounters a mysterious man, usually, or a mysterious artifact, or something suspect. He gets arrested, generally on the boat or right after getting off the boat. Escapes, and while escaping from the police, uncovers something about the mysterious man, has to flee more from the police, and ends up goes into the wild, and whether it's a Congolese tribe or India or Arabs or Native Americans from South Central or North America or Eskimos or whatever the fuck, or Chinese, but like he encounters the far peasantry, and right. They help him out. And he fights with like bandits or whatever, while being pursued by enterprising law enforcement people still, who also are generally like kind of comedic foils. And Tintin is generally a little more suave, and then the cops that follow him are kind of stepping on rakes.
Or in the case of Tintin in America, you know, he's being pursued by the criminals themselves.
Yes, he's there's usually a pursuer, cop, criminal, or. Sometimes it's like, whatever local law enforcement or local bad guy. And then he kind of returns to civilization, and there's generally some kind of final confrontation where Tintin acquires allies through either because he's Tintin and kind of a famous guy, or they're just like the local, like he just finds the local British, like Britbong guys, or the British government, whatever government there is, like colonial government. And Tintin and his allies confront the bad guys and generally arrest them with relatively few casualties, but a lot of gunfire. And
right.
Yes, and that's kind of like how every Tintin story pretty much goes. But they're also in the same way, like Tintin is. It's weird when you put on a date because it doesn't predate. Like serials, like the adventure serials that Indiana Jones is based off, in the kind of newsreel.
Yeah, that's what
form.
I was gonna say.
But
is
it
like
is, but it does that same thing
tropes.
Where.
Well,
it's, well, no, but it's contemporaneous with them. Like,
exactly,
Tintin's not that old, you know.
Exactly. Yeah,
Tintin is arguably ripping off, or like he is not ripping off. He's applying the format of the adventure
of the movie
serial.
Yeah,
to a comic strip.
Like I forget the one that was the inspiration for Indiana Jones. There were a couple, and what was it, Buck Rogers in the whatever century, and Flash Gordon and shit like that was all the rage, and that very much had this kind of comic. It was a comic book logic to it, and all those two. I mean, the earliest comic books and those serials and all that massive culture all kind of emerged at the same time and was riffing off each other, and in a way, because it was always already based on certain kinds of tropes, but it also originated the ways in which those tropes would tend to play out for visual media, really down to the present day. Even things like video games, or you know, video game logic and abilities and design logic is all kind of predicated on I don't know how you want to put it, but yeah, I would call it a certain kind of flowering of culture. It was, you know, considered in large part vulgar at the time, and I'm not going to pretend that it's super high culture, but it's there and it's good, and I think about this not infrequently too. I think in some ways, okay, so Tintin is Belgian, right? So it's European, so it's kind of different, but I think another example of a similar phenomenon that you see, especially in the United States, where I think the American culture of the 1920s, more or less, you know, the Roaring Twenties, was the last time you had a real efflorescence of culture and architecture and anything really. Everything, it's been one very long downhill plummet ever since. And we people talk about there's nothing good made anymore. And okay, there was some occasionally interesting pop culture in the 70s and 80s, but even that, I think, you know, the in large part is responding to this this period, and it's so, like,
right.
Even things like the you mentioned the colonial offices, colonial government, I don't think the problem with so there's this famous, I guess it was the second Tintin that was ever compiled, the as a book, the
Congo.
Tintin in the Congo, right? Which is the one that's kind of quasi banned. Like I bought, actually before you even brought up this episode, I knew I wanted to, you know, I have two boys, so I was like, okay, well, I want to do, you know, we can do some stuff and have fun with things that I enjoyed as a boy, and let's do Tintin. So I ordered all of the like a whole set of the Tintins, and I was like, wait, where's the one where he goes to Africa?
Right.
It's like, it's not in the compilation. You have to buy it separately. It's a collector's edition, and it's, you know, blah, blah, blah. I think so there are certain things about the representations of Congolese in that particular volume that are kind of silly, and they are playing a certain kinds of ethnic stereotypes, but I think it's not even so much that they're playing to this ethnic stereotype at like, in a bad way, so much as that they're playing to it at all.
In like a paternalistic sort of way.
In that particular volume, but even in the... Yeah, please, go on.
What's funny, actually, is historically, in Africa, it's actually their favorite one. Like, in Francophone Africa, their Tintin is the Tintin in the Congo. Like, that's the one that they think of, and it's something that's kind of a cultural touchstone in a lot of those countries, and Westerners, you know, who write about it have been surprised to find that out. But
well,
yeah,
it makes more sense if you think about it for, like, if you don't just like reflexively do the shit lib, like, well, it looks like blackface, bone and nose, bad. People who live in, like, you know, are French speaking Africans, you know, generally they live in like cities or, you know, some like developed areas. They don't view themselves as those, like, bone-and-nose spear-chuckers, right? They view the crazy bone-and-nose spear-chuckers outside the, you know, in the bush. Like, they don't see that as offensive to them because it's not denigrating them.
Yeah,
even if you think it as...
Yeah, like, yeah, we know you're not talking about us.
Yeah, it's like, you know, when shit-lib comedians do a show in, like, Birmingham, Alabama, and they do, like, have a rednecks... Their shit-lib audience is still like, no, it's not them,
right?
You know, it's the same kind of thing. Like, people aren't. I mean, it's kind of gets into, like, Ben Shapiro stuff. people aren't looking to be offended. I think even in terms of the
The places that aren't Africa is kind of where I was going with this. When he's in Arabia or he's in India, and everybody is doing the
snake charm. Actually,
Exactly. It's like Indians like that too. I mean, you know, everybody. I think there's almost a sense, even from that kind of a perspective of nostalgia. I mean, having traveled, you know, abroad quite extensively, I can say, like, there's a, yes, it's not just that people aren't offended. It's that there's a sense of pride in the kind of cultural,
like how they're represented, distinctiveness. Like elsewhere.
Yeah, like the distinctiveness that people understand. Like, this is what a North Indian, you know, Maharaja looks like, you know, and it has lots of gold on elephants and a big, you know, kind of vaguely Muslim looking, a castle or whatever. Like this is a source of pride and great, you know, yeah, just cultural pride and it's the distinctiveness of each culture, each region, geographically, but also anthropologically that Tintin ventures to. And I would, yeah, ultimately connect this back to the, I didn't realize this until I started doing prep for this episode. I knew, of course, we mentioned the Leon de Grel connection and how, you know, the great Leon de Grel, but what was his rank, specifically, Lewis?
I don't speak German, man.
he was an SS officer. Something.
The problem is he played World War II like a video game character. Where he enlists as a private and like hit every rank on the way up to general.
Yeah.
I believe anyway, Daniel Hill book credits him as.
Schutzstaffel is the SS. Yeah.
No, but it's like.
Stabschaffer? Is that the rank you're talking about?
It don't matter. I mean, the point is he was like.
Yeah.
Also, there's more weirdness. It's just bipolar autism. That the German veterans associations or like the self-identified, you know, whatever you want to call them, they don't consider promotions after a certain date in the war because things became too chaotic.
Yeah, of course.
And like, course. Okay, then your major whatever is now an acting general because he's like literally cut off from Berlin and can't talk to anyone.
Yeah.
But he's not actually a general, like, right?
He's just acting general in this pocket of whatever.
And I think de Grel was one of those guys. Also, they were, like, kicking out honorary promotions all over the place for, like, you know, at the very end. So, you know, if you're going to hold the line here, you're a general, you know? Like, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think de Grel got one of those. So I think he did end up being, like, kind of a...
He was kind of the equivalent of a colonel, and then he did end up becoming acting general in charge of you know his battle group or whatever in Belgium.
General is referred to as a colonel, and I don't think he would not claim to be like an SS general. I don't I think he when he wore his uniforms to troll the entire world at like Spanish. You know, royal events and stuff. I believe he wore a colonel's uniform. I don't think he was wearing.
Okay, that makes sense. But,
well, in that, bringing that back to bringing back de Grel and also kind of the serialized aspect of Tintin that you were talking about earlier. So, the way that Hergé, the author Georges Rémy, his pen name was his initials like backwards, so like RJ Hergé. So the way he was introduced to the comics, you know, with in the way that we see them, in the way that they were in America back then, was through Leon de Grel, who was a foreign correspondent for the same Catholic newspaper that he worked for.
He was covering the
Cristero War in Mexico, and he was traveling in the United States, and so he would send Rémy newspapers and comics from American newspapers and from local newspapers, and so that was the main way that he was exposed to that style of storytelling, and what largely inspired him to create the Tintin character.
It's also much cleaner than American cartoons of the era.
it's it draws a lot from like Donald Duck and like the Disney stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you watch stuff that's not look at comics that aren't Disney, it's almost unreadable. Like everything is labeled, and there's always a lot of wordplay. And I don't think RJ would obviously. I mean, I'm sure he spoke some level of English, but he would probably like not appreciate like I guess we call it the average comic back then was not. It was pretty rough. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Not as confident, I think. But like
the stuff he did before was kind of like, you know, pictures with like, you know, labels and with like text below the picture and things like that. Like the style of speech bubbles and cartoons as we know them. You know, that was very, very new for that time.
Yeah, but it's a lot cleaner. It's very, I would say it's very specifically he's doing like the Disney cartoon style, because the average cartoon, usually the average American cartoon, they're really not good. It's hard to explain. Like, it's like walls of text for the first three boxes, and then like images that are also covered in text, and then it all leads up to like a really, really, I guess it was hilarious back then, like some joke about some like wordplay or pun, and you just read it and you're like, what the fuck is this? Like, it is truly inaccessible. And you get into like things I think where there was a weird thing to the early forms of mediums where the concern is not like telling it, making a good movie or telling a good story or writing a good book. It's about like providing value for money. And you commit more time to reading this book. Like JRPGs are kind of famously like padded as a video game genre. Like there's a lot of padding in early stuff because you want to get like, I paid $6 for this video game.
Yeah, no, it was, I mean, Dickens was famously, right? Dickens was famously paid by the word and in general, those kind of early, a lot of novels, when we think of like the novel as a literary art form nowadays, and for the better part of 100 years, it's been bound and sold as a unit. But historically, it wasn't just Dickens. Like Dickens was getting paid by the word because it was serialized in a physical newspaper type magazine publication. Some of those were like, you know, the people are probably familiar, Americans, with, you know, the Atlantic is or Harper's Weekly, these kinds of periodicals in
the New Yorker sense.
The New Yorker, exactly. But it wasn't just that. It was also literally the way that, okay, newspapers.
Also, there was a part of time where everyone who read the New Yorker didn't deserve to be beaten to death. Yeah,
very much so. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Actually, written for people, not things with faces, as I said.
Yes, and newspapers would make it's the big, like, this is something of a tangent, but related to this kind of general picture. Because they were talking about on Tedious the other day, and it's been a kind of common theme. Why is the internet dying, or what is the problem with the internet? Well, fundamentally, there's a problem of revenue. Like, how do you monetize content? Because the thing is, everything. And I remember I was very cognizant of this as it was happening in the 90s into the early 2000s, where the constant fights over newspapers. There was a sense of newspapers should be free, and it was really, really hard. Still is basically impossible for newspapers in particular to make money. The reason isn't so much that people don't pay for subscriptions, because newspaper subscriptions have only ever been a tiny minority, like 10-20% typically of their income. Newspapers don't make money from subscriptions. Newspapers make money from advertisement, and not like full page ads for Sears, whatever, although they used to do that too. No, newspapers were Craigslist. Newspapers, it was the classifieds, were the big moneymaker for newspapers in particular. And this is a service that, like, is, you know, especially nowadays in the days of you know, 2-day free shipping, which is another kind of funny thing with Tintin, you know, the sense of physicality of travel, of, you know, airplanes are there, but they're kind of rickety. It's kind of hard to get in one with, you know, more than one engine. And yes, you know,
until the 70s and the 80s and the later ones. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Yeah. And so this the massive compression in time and space and the ability to just, yeah, you know, it's not like if you, you know, a classified could be, it doesn't just necessarily have to be something you want to buy or sell, but yeah, that's the kind of thing that it's a service that's no longer needed fundamentally. And so newspapers and the internet more broadly have been stuck in how do we replicate that? And I don't know that you can, but yeah, it's certainly interesting that the, this, the profit motive ultimately of these publications is to move units, right? And you want to move lots of units over time to lots of different people, which creates incentives for authors who are producing, you know, serialized content for these publications to stretch them out and to kind of go double back on itself and to have kind of, you know, things that may make sense on it. There was a number, when I was reading it in this with that eye, there were several points kind of obvious, you know, cliffhanger endings, like Tintin is, you know, in one frame, the end of a page, he's by himself looking toward in a coffin, literal floating coffin, about to be overtaken by a 20-foot wave. And then in the next frame, he wakes up on somebody's boat, like nothing ever happened. And it's just, you know, the next episode of the thing or whatever.
Yeah. And that was, you know, the serialization was, of course, you know, the result of Tintin being in a format of like a weekly strip for like the children's supplemental of the newspaper he was working for. And I've read something where he talked about that, where he talked about how it was kind of just a series of suspenseful gags, you know, one event leading into the next to kind of carry along the action and carry along the plot. And it didn't really become solidified with more coherent, longer plots until the Blue Lotus, he said. And then later on, you know, when Tintin became a proper magazine and things like that, you'd have you'd have it split to, like, you know, you get a weekly issue of the magazine, there's a page of the newest Tintin book or something, rather than a few panels a week.
Right, a few panels. I love the Blue Lotus was in particular one of my favorites that I remember from when I was a young man. The thing is that was what struck one of the things that struck me about the Tintin film, which again I do definitely recommend, was watching it. I had a vague sense of like feeling like the stories were a little bit more coherent than that and didn't just totally kind of go from one sequence to another. But no, the early Tintin, the earliest, you know, compilations of these serialized comic strips are very much like that. And it's whatever. It's not that it doesn't work. It's more just I think you mind less maybe if you're, yeah, like a 9, 10, 11, 12 year old boy. Just there's this young boyish. Let's talk about the character of Tintin, because I think he's part of the success of the product of the franchise or whatever you want to call it is the ability of essentially young white boys to see themselves reflected in his rosy cheeks. No.
Yeah, I would say so. It is kind of a thing of his kind of eternal youth. I mean, the comic starts in 1929 with Land of the Soviets, and he's, you know, he's supposed to be, what, 15, 16 or something. And then the last book is Tintin the Picaro is 1982. He looks basically the same. I mean, obviously the difference, the aesthetic difference between Land of the Soviets and the very last one is pretty stark, but he looks pretty much the same throughout the vast majority of the series. And so it is kind of like each one is like they all bleed into each other. There's all you know, plot, like you see books reference each other and stuff, but he's still the same age.
What Tintin is, because this I see this a lot actually, because what he's supposed to be is like, he is not like a character, a self-insert of the. Assuming the reader is a you know, say 8 to 12 year old, right? Or 8 to 13 year old. He's not supposed to be the reader. He's supposed to be the reader when he's older, right?
Like, yeah, when he's 25. When you're 13, this is me when I'm 26.
Yes. And he, because of that, he represents a certain kind of not wealthy, but like what a educated European man, but not so educated, but not necessarily wealthy, just like went to college. And that's why he's comfortable with like what sort of used to be kind of the expectation that like if you had been to college, you were, and this was a universal with literacy, like you were a reserve officer in your military, you know, like of your nation. You were, had some kind of athletic ability, you know, you were kind of a jack of all trades. You could probably speak a few languages, maybe some classics, you know, or for usually for sure some classics. And so he's kind of like an aspirational, he's specifically not wealthy. Like if he was rich, he'd be like a sportsman or whatever.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, like Captain Haddock is in, you know, the country gentleman, Marlin Spike in the later books.
Yeah. He has thin bills, right? So he's not,
I mean, yeah, he lives in a flat, you know, he travels a lot, you know, most of his expenses probably go to that sort of thing. Like he's, you know, he's a professional.
Enough money, but he, for whatever it is that he needs, but he also has to be careful about it, which like a true aristocrat would never be, even if they were, you know, broken in debt or whatever, like they, you know, they would never, ever, ever do anything so, crass as to be appearing to, you know, need money for anything, right? Whereas he like actually does need to yeah, it's an interesting and the, I don't know so much about the, he feels he's comfortable wherever. That's the other thing, is he's part of this is the colonial thing, the unapologetic, like, yes, of course, you know, Europe rules the world in some sense, and wherever, you know, we can go to China, India, Africa, wherever, and it doesn't, you know, we will be polite and we will follow, you know, the local customs and of course the international norms, is, you know, whoever the colonial master is, you know, France here and England there and whatever, you know, they are the ones who have the white goons that'll come after you if you really fuck up. But you know, the brown goons or whatever, and they're in the local dress and we'll be in the local dress, but there's never a sense of a foreignness, in a way, it's always there's a sense
of some exoticism, yeah. but not foreignness. Like he's
well, I'm doing tourism, but I have a handgun as well.
Yeah.
Like part of a tourist's uniform,
which
until
is my right as relatively a white recently man in a white man's in a colony run by white men. Like yes, of course, a white man, you know, can walk around with a pistol and in wherever,
yeah, he's running around the Congo, you know, shooting antelopes, blowing up rhinos, all kinds of stuff.
Well, Congo is owned by Belgium, and he's Belgian, so why wouldn't he?
Mm. And Hergé definitely, you know, moved away from the colonial ethic later on. I mean, he, when, you know, he focused, I guess, more of the themes of you know, kind of international brotherhood or wherever or whatever. You know, he regretted in many ways, you know, the paternalistic aspect of Tintin in the Congo, but the same ethos is still there throughout all the books, regardless.
Well, it was the ethos of the time. I mean, that's, I think the I don't feel I expressed myself super well, and I don't know, maybe it's just not well formed enough or not correct enough to really get out. But there was something about this at least to me, I guess, that and maybe it's just a personal attachment then, I don't know, but this there was a moment from, yeah, like 1922 to 1938 where like all of the, you know, these we're still living in the shadow of the, even just, I think the clothes and the dress, you can see, you if you look, I'm looking now at, you know, the Wikipedia page, and you see the people used to dress nice. I guess they dressed to some extent in, you know, through the 50s and 60s, but the just every aspect of this culture, yeah, I don't know. I'm not
took itself seriously, you know, was more you know, it was prouder of itself, I guess.
Yes, for sure. And recognize itself as being a culture. Recognize itself as and which we just, you know, the nowadays it's of course there is in a certain perverse sense something you could call quote unquote American culture, but it's, you know, lesbian football players and various assorted, you know, horrors. It's not like, you know,
the combination of like deconstruction of everything and the reduction of everything to products and units and consumerism.
And what is it? I guess that's what I'm getting at. What is it that they're deconstructing? Is this right? Is more than any other single thing? This was this cultural moment for the Western world is like the eternal object of deconstruction and that the culture distortion. Of the culture distorters, this is the culture that they're most interested in distorting.
Exactly.
Lewis, did you have? I wasn't sure. Do you have any other thoughts, or was there, I feel we didn't get to? Do you want to say more about Tintin the character?
Let's do. I kind of wanted to. So there's about that he's like, you know, that he's more swashbuckling because the average European man was expected to be more swashbuckling at the time. Mm-hmm. But there's also he is also like a boy hero, like having the pet dog, right? Like these are, you know, generally you come of age as, and you kind of don't, you know, you don't have the pet dog with you when you leave home, right? You know, you can leave the dog at home. You know, that's you know, he's constantly doing youth elements. He's
never has a GF, which is kind of interesting. Well, yeah,
I was going to bring that up. Like, so that was like, he's also like not a romantic, which is, oh, Tintin's gay or whatever dumb thing you would say. But it's actually that, like, when you're
he's too busy for hoes.
When you're when you're 11 year old boy, you're thinking about your adventure. You're not thinking about, like, you know, that's not a part of the story, like, at all, you know?
Yeah.
Which does actually, like, how there's a formula. It really, really narrows, like, Tintin's adventures more, because in the adventure kind of, like, serial genre that he's in, like, femme fatales are, like, you know, that's a good third of all your plots, and they just
do the closest thing you got to that in Tintin is, you know, Castafiore, so...
Who is who is
the opera singer who's in love with Captain Haddock? Oh,
right. Yeah, and she's like older, right?
Yeah. There have been bootleg Tintin comics over the years. I mean, there's a whole, it was kind of a strange kind of underground industry of like bootleg Tintin comics where he's like, you know, having sex and stuff. There's like one where he goes to Thailand, like does all this crazy stuff, and that was, of course,
Tintin
very
in the land
heavily,
of the ladyboys.
Yeah, like very heavily looked down upon, you know, and rightfully so by Tintin purists, by anyone respectable, you know, because that's not who he is. That's not part of the character. It's not what Hergé wanted in mind at all. I mean, it's like he has a specific thing he sets out to do, a specific ethic he sets out to embody. And you know, women don't really fit into that.
That's the other thing. I mean, I it's funny because I found myself talking about like Faustianism and stuff, and I'm not like that shit sounds cringe and dumb, and I'm not a Spenglerian really. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I do. I mean, the thing is, I very much. Sorry, one minute.
Oh my God! You're bring in Faust and Spangler and walk off. Who does that? I'm trying to podcast here, guy. All right. Wow.
Faust, what? Spangler, where is he going with this? I mean, I can kind of forward. Yeah, I can kind of understand. I guess, you know, what he's getting at. I mean, it all comes down to, a distinctly European ethos that is embodied, that I think in large part it was unconscious, you know, whether Hergé realized it or not. I mean, that was just
sorry
kind
about
of
that, guys. I was
kind of what all stories embodied back then.
Yeah. Well, also we would put just the inter. So DK has to say, in the interwar period was like Europe was still confident and all this stuff, and yeah, there's some of that, But it's also just the best setting for anything in the 21st century. Like, if you're going to set
narrative,
like, and that's why they, I don't think he's stuck in the interwar period forever because it was out of some, like, stable European period. It's just that's when all the interesting stuff happened.
And also when he's writing. I mean, because a lot of, like, there's the first couple of
He stayed in the interwar period. Like, he wrote until the 80s, right? But 1938 never happened.
Well, they did. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, because the first couple are written in the 20s and 30s. And then Land of the Black Gold was written during World War II. Hergé was... he was a reservist in the Belgian army, and that's when he was writing the bulk of Land of the Black Gold. And you can see the kind of like looming threat of war and stuff in it. And then, you know, during the war, he writes Shooting Star. You know, we got the Jewish villain in there. And then after that, all the other books are in, like, you know, kind of Cold War era until the 80s when Hergé passed away.
Set in the Cold War era, really.
No, they are. Like Calculus Affair is, you know, has a very like Cold War spy feel. You got the Borgerian standing in for the Soviets. Picaros is, you know, you got the San Theodoros forces. You know, it's kind of a Cuban revolution sort of thing. You got the moon landing and Destination Moon, Explorers on the Moon. So he always embodied the time in which he was set. I mean, he was always really big on putting the latest technology in, you know, putting all the cool details that people wanted to see. That was always a big part of it.
Yeah. Maybe I'm just not deep enough into Tintin, but it seems like whenever he goes to India, I guess I haven't read the more recent stuff because I kind of read it without kind of any intention. But every time he goes to India, it seems like he's talking to some British guy who's in charge. Every time
even when it's set in the quote unquote, I understand what you're saying, and I get what, like, maybe in terms of the plot, some of the cultural touchstones, but yeah, at least certainly in my experience, it's not just that it's in that interwar period. It's that interwar period itself is in many ways a kind of reflection of the 19th century thing. Like culturally, the depictions of India are drawing on touchstones more from the 1890s even than the 1920s or 30s. So,
right, because he in Tintin in Tibet. I mean, that was written in what, at the like late 70s, and he goes to India and he goes to Tibet and everything. And it's, of course, like post independence and everything. But you still have that sort of Orientalist vibe and everything. And it's still, I mean, I'm sure Tibet was still pretty primitive in the 70s, but you know, you still definitely have that same feel.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So it's as you say, almost more of a vibe than necessarily like particular plot touchstones and yeah, how the characters are represented and all this kind of stuff. I think that's the thing. That's like I think it's more accurate to say the world ended in 1918 than in 1945. But the world of the interwar period was, it really in many ways an extension ultimately of the pre-World War One civilization, the pre-Great War. We should just go back to calling it the Great War. Because that, you know, that was really, yes, the kind of last hope was extinguished for, really not the last hope, but the, 1945 drew it to a kind of final close in a way that 1918 ultimately didn't. Anyway, yeah, but it's always, I guess that I'm just thinking through why is this period so attractive? Why does it feel right when you see, you know, when you see, they've been doing very similar kind of thing, this the Poirot, Hercule Poirot, the investigator, isn't he also Belgian? He wasn't French. He was,
I think he was Belgian, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a funny kind of thing, right? Of, but yeah, this Agatha Christie world of the interwar, period is there's a reason why it's very popular, but I do think the our cultural overlords consider it also very dangerous for obvious reasons.
Yeah, well, I mean, in some ways, I think it's something that can be used. I mean, because like Indiana Jones, you have that same adventurous swashbuckling ethic,
his whole thing is he wants to punch Nazis, which is
that's how
they get around that problem.
Yeah, that's how it can be, you know, that sort of romance of the era can be used of, you know, oh, you know, you got the looming threat, you got the big bad guys, those evil Nazis on the horizon. You know, it adds almost to the danger of it in some way. So it can be co-opted for sure, but I think the essential notion of, you know, it's an era when there was still, you know, there was still a serious European culture that asserted itself, and, you know, you still had that adventuring ethic, then, you know, as long as that exists, that still presents somewhat of a danger.
That's what I was going to say before. I was going to try to edit it, but I guess you guys kept talking, which is fine. So I'll just fuck it, whatever. People, you see, Baby used to scream in the microphone.
I forgot about him.
Anyway, that's what I was going to say is I am not a Faustian, ideologically, theologically, whatever. But I was a 9 to 15 year old boy who, looked at rocket ships and, thought of, yes, going out into the world in this very Faustian way, maybe Odysseus is, or I guess you could say Odysseus is a Faustian archetype. But yeah, this sense of exploration, the sense of there's this whole big wide world out there, and I am going to go and explore it, and not just the world, but ultimately a universe, and everything, the totality, you know, the macrocosm that Faust, the character, was so concerned with.
That was part of the appeal of the world, because, you know, in those days, you know, especially in the interwar era when he first started writing, I mean, there were still parts of the world that were relatively unexplored, and Hergé continually went back to that. I mean, he went to, you know, Tintin was always at the furthest frontiers. I mean, whether it was space, you know, in Destination Moon, Explorers on the Moon, right. he was talking about moon landing stuff, you know, in the mid 50s. And then, of course, you know, Tibet, the far mountains of the Himalayas, and, you know, you've got the in Flight 714, the tropical islands, and you ultimately get to, you know, aliens and stuff like that. I mean, it's always the final frontier. He's always exploring something, and that's the most important thing.
Well, also, I kind of wanted to relate it to, because of the tech stuff, in that, so James Bond is kind of like eternally, obviously James Bond, you know, does kind of a similar thing, right? He's going to space, doing stuff.
Okay, I got it. So Tintin is a 13-year-old projecting himself at 26. James Bond is a 52-year-old also projecting himself at 26.
Right. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's good.
But they're saying the same era where, so James Bond actually isn't like a Cold War spy drama at all. It's an interwar spy drama. It's like,
yeah,
it's about, it's just set in the Cold War because Cold War spying was very lame. It was like, wow, this Jew in the American government just gave the Bolsheviks documents. What a great fucking cool story, bro. No, like, interwar spying was, you know, this cool maze of, like, everyone's drunk and they're going to the trunk. You know?
Oh, and, they still have the club. You know, you can, some of these clubs, like in Cambodia, there's a famous one. Like, everybody, the bars still exist where the colonial officers and the State Department, diplomats and the spies and the journalists would all get hammered together. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like, that's kind of it's kind of in the same way that the American Wild West is, like, every story, like No Country for Old Men is set in the modern era, but it's actually set, well, it's set in, like, I guess 86 or whatever. But it's actually set in the Old West, right? Like, there's people, like, tonally, like, history really ended in 1945, you know, or in America's case, 1917. I think arguably because World War One kind of ended American, you know, like kind of having a frontier or having just history be interesting at all, right?
Right,
like,
right.
Interesting times. And that's kind of the Tintin is just like, it's just interesting times straight into my veins. You're kind of just, you know, intravenously drip of like, oh, this is gonna be fun. Like, you know, oh, he goes into, I'm gonna go to Tunisia on vacation and get drafted into the Tunisian army and then desert under cover of night, you know, or whatever. Like, stuff that's just unheard of now. But like, was a legitimate concern if you were, traveling in when things were interesting, you know?
Right, right, exactly, exactly.
Was there, I'm trying to think of another angle, if there was something that I, was there anything else you wanted to bring, or we didn't get, I wanted to talk a little bit about this because I sort of alluded to it, or we talked a little and then we didn't finish the bit. So not only the newspaper itself where mm-hmm. the comics were published by Hergé was a essentially a fascist paper. I didn't quite
it was hardline Catholic. I mean, it
Rexist,
was it was Rexist supporting in a lot of
Sorry,
ways.
Yes,
yeah,
not fascist, not National Socialist, Rexist. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Was it the same paper that Degrelle was later the editor of, or was that a different one?
No, it wasn't. It was called Le Vingtième Siècle, which means, you know, the 20th century in French. So it was a Catholic newspaper. I think it had relatively wide circulation, but and so Hergé wrote for, I think Degrelle did write for it for a bit, but Hergé was he started out wanting to be a journalist, but ended up, you know, they saw his talent in illustrating and he became kind of the comic artist for it. And the guy, his direct supervisor, was a priest named Father Norbert Wallet. And he kept a picture of Mussolini in his office. You know, he was a very fascist sympathizing guy too. So he was, you know, it was under his direction that he wrote like Land of the Soviets, you know, exposing the veil of Bolshevism and things like that. And kept Hergé going in that direction for the first few books. And then so Degrelle and Hergé, you know, of course kept up correspondence and, you know, were friends before the war. And he did actually offer Hergé the position of being the official illustrator of the Rexist movement. And Hergé, he drew a few posters for them in the mid-30s, actually. But he, he ultimately declined, and which, you know, of course, was ended up being good for his future career. But, you know, and people would scrutinize his former associations with Degrelle, unfortunately, in the coming years. And it was
I think that's one thing that's not really reflected on, and then like why would people think of the inherent instability of democracy, or just like West, like the current neoliberal order or democracy or whatever you're going to call it, just like the inherent contradiction of the West and liberal democracy is that it gives some expression to like liberalism. You have your Republican parties and bullshit. It gives some expression to the more socialistic, social, you know, communistic leaning thing. But like a whole one third of the political spectrum, because it really isn't like left right is not really quite how it works, right? There's like this, there's this third thing that was extremely popular.
And yeah. I still am a fan of the Hearts of Iron 3 political. The Hearts of Iron 3 political ideology meter has fascism, liberalism, and communism as forming a triangle. There is no left or right, or if there are, it's like internal. It's on the within the like liberal end of the triangle, but it's left and right within liberalism converge at ultra liberal, right? You know what I mean?
Yes.
Which like no lies detected. So yes, I'm a big fan of that conceptualization.
And I think that is a weird scar in Western Europeans. Actually have it the worst, because, you know, they were generally occupied by the Germans, which like meant people were kind of just openly doing that thing. And then all of a sudden they couldn't, and you have to like, so they purge these impulses, but you can't ever do that. It's going to become inherently unstable. And I think that's arguably why liberalism has run so far amok, is because there's always this like creeping fascism thing behind them. Like when you see elites say like, oh, we need more migrants to like punish like the locals. And that's something you occasionally see. Like that's because they see themselves as like running from an inevitable wave, you know, and in theory, if there was just fascist parties allowed, liberalism would be much healthier, even if you like sincerely believed in it, you know. That's kind of drawing far afield from Tintin.
I don't think it is. I don't think it is at all. Because the interesting thing is, okay, so like, what is it specifically like? So I was looking over this on it's on the Wikipedia page. I'd be curious to read some of the more original source material. So according to Wikipedia, but whatever, Le XXe siècle, the publication where it first emerged, essentially it was supposed to be ideologically, like the cartoon strip was an ideological project of an ideological publication that was shut down under German occupation when Belgium was occupied by Germany during the war. But Hergé himself continued to produce this comic book, right? Sorry, go on.
Yeah, and that was when during the 40s was when he wrote The Shooting Star, which is considered one of his most controversial works, because he later claimed that's like, oh, you know, it wasn't really any sentiment behind it, you know, I was just working like everyone else was during that time. But you know, you have the Jewish financier who's the villain running the rival expedition to reclaim this meteorite that's crashed in the Arctic, and all the people on the European expedition are from either Axis aligned or neutral countries. And originally the rival expedition, so it was headed. It was sponsored by a Jewish financier named Blumenstein, and it was headed, from the United States. Like, there's an American flag on the ship and everything. And then later they changed it. He changed it, and it was some made up country that was sponsoring it. And the financier, they didn't change the way he looked at all. They changed the name, and his name is Bullwinkle. And Hergé named it after some sort of dessert or something that they have in Belgium. But it turns out that was also a Jewish surname that some people in Belgium had. So he didn't really accomplish anything with that. But that's a very interesting story there, and it's a cool book too.
I'll have to, yeah, that one I don't know that I've read before, and I.
It's the one with the giant mushrooms.
Okay, I'll. You'll
probably see it.
But I mean, I guess the reason why I emphasized, I think, Lewis, that it's much more related than you're giving it credit for is, you know, okay, with that partial exception, which is arguably not even, I mean, it's the kind of thing where, like, a Jewish financier up to no good, you know, is you know, that's not something that Hergé invented in 1940, whatever, right?
Yeah, like, it's pretty par for the course.
It's not, I'm just saying, like, that in and of itself is already a well-established historical reality-based literary trope. So, but the question is, like, what, you know, what makes that comic book, in a neutral sense, let's call it propaganda? Like, in what sense is you can say the Soviets, and he's critiquing maybe the Soviet system in certain ways, but liberals would have had pretty much identical for the most part kind of critiques, right? So what is it about Tintin that is fascist or whatever, Rexist?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, you have, like, so Hergé, he was very, heavily involved in scouting when he was a kid, and it was kind of the Boy Scout ethic that largely informed his portrayal of Tintin, and it's that kind of patriotic, stand-up sort of ethos that informs Tintin, informs the... the conversation around it, and I think in many ways is compatible with the ideology that the paper espoused, and with the general kind of sense of the time.
I have a less big brain take. It's that Tintin is just like cool and normal.
Yeah.
and fascism is cool and normal.
Yeah.
And, that's probably a bigger, it's really a smarter take than mine, honestly.
Yeah, no, that's kind of, I didn't ask it with an answer in mind or anything. I asked because I'm working through it myself, but that sounds like the right answer.
Yeah, because, like, also I do like his, like, it's just like how a normal, like, Western European views, like, of the time and any time. Kind of viewed the world, and he didn't continue to view the world, and he just wasn't, like, just not mean spirited. But it's like, oh, look at them. The funniest thing about, like, his, like, the kind
sure.
of Tintin imperialism and paternalism is that he treats, like, the Soviet Union as if it's like India.
he does.
It's like, oh, well, oh, look at these peasants. You know, it's like, oh, you go to the big city and then you leave, and there's peasants. You know, the peasants in the it's just like they're Eskimo or something. Which is,
yeah, he's like, what are these naughty Bolsheviks doing now? Like, come now.
But he does treat it in a very like that's actually the most oldest school French view or French Belgian same thing like view of Russia is that oh it's actually not a, it's not Europe it's like this weird colony where this European monarchy rules this kind of this frozen peasant horde and he didn't update his priors at all like with the Soviet Union and Bolshevism. It's really, yes, there's, like, Soviet stuff, imagery there, and occasionally he'll do, like, you know, it's really no different than, like, him going to any kind of, the
third
evil
world backward shithole.
Yeah, Arabian sheik's land is, like,
yeah, right.
It's just, like, it's just, the, yeah. instead of being a desert, it's snowy. So, yeah. No,
yeah,
that's
interesting. I haven't thought about it that way, but, yeah, you do see that in Land of the Soviets, for sure.
Yeah. I also do want to point out about like there's a lot of bullshit in these books like where it there's like a every serial we'll call them like little individual sub narrative they can all resolve like I guess like two basic ways is like it's going to resolve or at least three well three ways you can just like the story can just advance right. But usually, like, when there's a confrontation, there's either realistic violence or, like, cartoon bullshit. Like, you know, like, he's...
I mean, how many times
like, I really like the realistic violence or, like, just the constant not shying from, like, gunfire. We're going to have Tintin with a gun
completely.
Constantly.
It's I think, one of the weakest parts of the thing is when they're you know because there's like there's a gun and there's a very sense there's a sense that the gun is quite lethal and there's some kind of grounding in some kind of physical realism and then the next you know a couple panels down he jumps on someone's belly and uses that as a springboard like as a trampoline to get over a wall and it's like okay I mean
well that's part of the kind of part of the childishness of it you know the whimsy I guess you could say. No one really gets, I mean, I'm trying to remember, I think he gets shot like a couple times, but I mean, for all the gunfire
he's often
in the
missed.
Series,
yes, he's very skinny.
It's a stormtrooper.
Right.
There's that aspect of it, but there's also the, like, yes, there's whimsy, but like.
It's still grounded.
This is a weird thing where it chooses to be grounded. This, like, the Wes Anderson has the same bullshit in his terrible films, which I hate and don't like at all. but the problem with that is that it does feel like when you're reading, I guess also because I'm too old to read this. I went back and read Cigars of the Pharaoh for this episode, and I am like, I shouldn't be reading. I've aged out of it. It's for generations.
Yeah, that was my feeling as well. I hadn't read it in forever, and I was like, "Oh,
whatever." I get to like, they're doing like serious violence or like just resolving it through like plot means. I'm like, okay, cool. And then I see like, oh, he's whipping a snake around his head into a snake lasso to jump over a gorge. Like, we're doing cartoon. Like,
right. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, because you do see. Yeah, you do see that sort of thing. And the last time I looked at, you know, read the actual books, you know, however many months ago that was, you know, you do see as you age, you know, you see yourself kind of aging out of the gags and stuff. But then I think every time you read it, you also, you know, in my experience at least, and you know, in other, you know, I guess dedicated bands, you know, people come back to it more. You do see new things, you know. You see little pieces of the dialogue, you know, jokes that might go over kids' heads and things like that. Things that are silly that is kind of in a different way.
It's better than the way that like say Looney Tunes, the contemporary, which is Looney Tunes, does it, where Looney Tunes have like a hidden dick joke, or whatever. Which is not. I'm not that there's a problem with that. I think that you can do a hidden dick joke in a kid's thing. I actually don't think it's like Jewish subversion to do that.
Yeah, I mean, because the kid's not going to notice it. I mean, when they do and they get older, it's silly,
poetry,
you know.
But Tintin does a different way, like in that it just doesn't shy ever from adult stuff. Like there's cigars and guns and whiskey constantly, you know, and all this other, like they just like they'll talk about, I'm a narcotics suppression officer for the Royal Police in India. Like, there is, like, opium dens and to the stuff. And to a kid, it's like, oh, you don't know what the fuck that is. Like, you don't care.
I mean, I was seven years old looking at this. I'm like, that's interesting, you know.
Like, oh, clearly a brothel or whatever, you know. Like, but it's just, like, whatever, who cares? And I think that's a more advanced way to do it. Because you're doing the same thing where you make, like, you're sliding a sex joke past a kid. You're doing the same thing where, like, oh, someone older will get more out of this. But it's like when you're an adult and you go watch Looney Tunes and you catch one of those jokes, you're like, oh wow, I didn't catch that. It's whatever. But when you go back and, you know, read something as a kid, you see like that just the world was more adult and you didn't notice it. It is a more satisfying feeling than like just, oh, I get the joke, you know?
Yeah, right. And it's interesting. I mean, it that kind of shows. Kind of, yeah, the real worldliness of it, you know, is of course, yeah, like I said earlier, is one of the main draws. I mean, you know, you got Blue Lotus, you got the backdrop of the Chinese invasion of Japan, you know, you've got the moon ones and the calculus affair kind of have a Cold War backdrop. But then you've also got, you know, a lot of the plot points. It's just they're fun because they're creative and interesting. Like, you know, you got seven crystal balls and Prisoners of the Sun, where you got like a secret cult of Incas hiding out in the Andes Mountains that are like, you know, secretly drugging and possessing European scientists with the spirit of a dead Inca mummy. And you've got Flight 714 with you know, this guy is an evil millionaire taking over an island, and turns out there's like a secret alien temple in the volcano and stuff like that. And it's just, you know, it's fun. Like, no matter what age you are, it's fun. It's cool.
Well, I think that's probably enough. I don't know. I'm thinking of anything else I want to get out. Do we have any closing thoughts?
Don't let your kid use cell phone so he can read Tintin. If you burn your child's, you know, media engagement, you know, brain, then he will not be able to read Tintin. It is accessible, but it is not as easy as the, you know, the tablet. So be aware of that, right? Like,
right,
you can
right.
give him this gift of Calvin and Hobbes and Tintin, all this stuff, if you don't burn his infant brain with the tablet. So.
Yeah, that's an important takeaway, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, and it also functions. I mean, it's a recommendation also, right? Like, definitely this is appropriate in all sorts of ways. And I think it's really great. Obviously buy as many copies of the Tintin in the Congo as you it seems kind of on the chopping block as far as
your child needs to read Tintin when he's 10, so he can read Berserk when he's 17, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, or, you know, in my case, you know, yeah, in my case, you know, I read Tintin when I was six and seven, so I could read, King Solomon's Mines by H. Rider Haggard when I was, you know, 12, 13. Yeah. So, but yeah, that's a good takeaway, definitely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for suggesting this topic. Thank you so much for coming on. If you have any other things you want to do, yeah, it'd be great to talk more in the future. All right. Till then, take care, everybody.